There is this moment from April that I've been thinking about a lot this week. It's when the Amazon Labor Union won the long shot vote to unionize its first warehouse in the U.S., a facility called JFK 8 in Staten Island. And it was simply huge, considering this was Amazon, a company as responsible as any for transforming American work life over the last generation. It was a massive, joyful victory for the small upstart union known as the ALU.
We got the juggler. We went for the juggler. And we went for the top dog because we want every other industry, every other business to know that things have changed. We're gonna unionize. We're not going to quit our jobs anymore.
But when I asked Noam Scheiber, who covers labor for the New York Times, what he remembered from that moment, he had a very different mental image. One from before all the jubilation.
You could watch the video of the count. You know, the NLRB was streaming that on Zoom. And you just saw all these kind of lawyers in suits. And then Chris Smalls, the president of the ALU, sitting there in his kind of in his red jumpsuit with his knees kind of bouncing up and down, you know, and every time we get a little closer, his knees would become like a little more frenetic. And you could just tell that the air was going out of the Amazon side and he was just getting closer to this thing that he'd kind of dreamed about, but didn't even entirely believe was possible himself.
How would you describe their mood now?
You know, I think we've come a long way. It's only been 6 months or so, but it probably feels like years to them. I think initially they were clearly unprepared for the crush of attention and frankly pressure that would be placed on them after they won.
Everybody, especially reporters, wanted a piece of Chris Smalls and Derek Palmer, the union leaders. Amazon tried to overturn the vote, filing 25 objections, which meant almost a month of hearings. Then the union lost a vote at a smaller New York warehouse in May. Plus, there was conflict within the ALU over what its priorities should be.
So it was a very tumultuous and unsettled time. I think now, fast forwarding several months, they've had a pretty important decision by the hearing officer who was hearing Amazon's objections to the election outcome. And that officer recommended that the election stand, that Amazon's objections be set aside. So that was certainly a big shot in the arm. They have also really started to focus on organizing at that warehouse, at JFK 8. In the last month or two, they brought in some professional organizers. They've held trainings. They've held a national organizing call. So I think now they are sort of where they hope to be a few weeks after the election. But it took, instead of a few weeks, it took several months.
Now the ALU is facing another vote, this time at a warehouse near Albany. And the votes will be tallied on Tuesday.
This is a big deal. I think the ALU folks would say, look, Albany is important. We're obviously trying to reach out to other warehouses. We want to expand this movement. But it's not the end-all and be-all for us. The end-all and be-all is really getting a contract on Staten Island. So the ALU folks have downplayed it a bit. But look, it's hard to deny that this will reflect on the ALU one way or the other.
Today on the show, another round in the fight between Amazon and its upstart union. Is it just one vote in one warehouse or a larger referendum on a new kind of labor movement? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Noam says the Amazon labor union has had a pretty good fall. Just before Labor Day, Amazon's challenge to the Staten Island union vote was rejected, though that process isn't entirely finished. and the ALU brought in more organizers to work on the effort at JFK 8. They threw a barbecue in September, and Noam stopped by.
You know, this particular barbecue, I think, was fortuitously timed because Amazon had just announced wage increases really in every warehouse across the country. But at JFK 8, the raise was lower than at most places. It turned out that the wage increases at JFK 8 were between 25 cents and 75 cents an hour, depending on your tenure and your level. And people were very frustrated. People come out on their break and they go to the ALU barbecue and they're like, man, you know, I wasn't necessarily that amped up for the ALU before I had that meeting with my supervisor this morning, but now, you know, I'm kind of into it. And so I think they benefit, you know, from some lucky timing there. And Chris, you know, being the savvy marketer that he is and kind of having, you know, pretty sophisticated political antenna, was all over this. You know, he was like, we're not falling for that 25 cent raise, Jeff Bezos, you're going to have to do better, you know, and, you know, people respond to that.
But Noam says the event also reflected some of the messiness plaguing the union after last spring's vote.
People would come by and they'd say, hey, you know, is Chris going to be here? And they would ask, you know, kind of ALU officers and senior ALU people. And they'd kind of scratch their head and be like, oh, they'd ask, you know, look over their shoulder. Is Chris going to be here? Is he going to be in LA? You know, so, you know, and then finally someone said, yeah, he's definitely going to be here. But you could kind of tell that this wasn't the most like tightly organized, immaculately scheduled organization. So you did see some of the, you know, kind of the seams show too, I think.
Smalls and some of the other union leaders have been spending time talking with workers from the Albany warehouse, which is known as ALB1. It's a smaller facility than JFK 8, about a tenth of the size, with only 800 workers. And it tends to handle larger items, think lawnmowers, mattresses, and kayaks, which have led to injuries and safety concerns from workers. Plus, the facility just had a fire.
There was a cardboard compactor that caught fire about a week ago. But actually, a very similar compactor had caught fire at JFK 8 too a few days earlier. This is apparently an issue that has just kind of dogged Amazon for a while. These compactors, for whatever reason, catch fire easily. Both facilities had these compactors that caught fire within 2 days. But I think the broader issue at this facility is they deal with these very large, very heavy items. And, you know, you could just imagine that if you're not using like the absolute best posture and using, you know, the kind of soundest, you know, techniques, it would be very easy to get injured. And there was a report by an advocacy group in New York that found that this was the Amazon facility with the highest rate of serious injury in New York. So that's certainly been a theme of the campaign that that the union has pushed very hard and, you know, with some justification, I think.
I'm also interested in kind of the politics of the surrounding area. They're very different than they are in the New York metro area. Like, how does that factor into the process? Or does it? Is it irrelevant?
So Albany itself, I believe it's the highest rate of union membership of any metro area in the country. And I think that's largely driven by the number of public service workers in Albany. They tend to be heavily unionized, but there's also a kind of manufacturing tradition in Albany too. So you get this kind of intersection of different industries that have a history of being unionized. So I think that in some ways helps the union. Definitely unions are not an alien concept to people, which can, you know, can be a barrier in a lot of industries, a lot of workplaces. But in some ways it kind of cuts the other way, I think. There are people who by the time they get to Amazon have had a union job before, and the fact that they're no longer in it and they came to Amazon may, you know, can mean in some cases that they had a bad experience with a union. So I think this high union density and this general familiarity with unions, it's kind of a double-edged thing at that warehouse. And, you know, the other thing there is, this is actually in a town called Castleton on Hudson. It's, you know, 15, 20 minutes southeast of Albany. And it's a much more exurban, kind of much redder politically place than Albany proper. And so the politics of the immediate area around the warehouse, I would say, are more conservative, no question. And so you get a little of that. You know, you see people in Trump hats and with Trump bumper stickers on their cars. And it's just, you know, a little more complicated than than if you were in the city of Albany proper.
One of the leaders of this nationwide union push, Heather Goodall, is an employee at ALB1. Does that help the union effort to have, you know, a person who's so intimately involved with this be one of them?
Yeah, well, I would say generally, and certainly at JFKA, the Staten Island facility, it was a huge advantage for the union to have most of the organizers be employees of the warehouse. I think that was unquestionably a key to their success on Staten Island. Heather, I think, is a somewhat more complicated figure. She joined that warehouse in February, and she joined because she had very, you know, real concerns about the rate of injury at that facility. And her ambition when she joined was to help unionize this facility. So I think for some folks at the warehouse, that is credibility enhancing. You know, you cared so much about this that you got a job here and tried to do something about it. I think for others, it's a source of skepticism that she's, you know, an outsider and has decided to take this upon herself, and that it doesn't originate as organically from the workers who were there before she got there. So I think it kind of cuts both ways. But there is no question that generally, the fact that the ALU has relied on workers and people employed at the warehouse to be their frontline organizers, that has been a huge advantage, you know, since the beginning of the JFK campaign.
People and personality have been key to the ALU's success. Chris Smalls, the union's charismatic president, helped sway votes by repeatedly connecting with workers outside JFK 8. He'd greet them at the bus, offer food, and generally be charming. But after the win, the union was split on what was the best use of his time. Was it national interviews to get the message out to a wider audience? Or was it on-the-ground daily organizing?
I think it's easy to forget, but a few weeks after they won that initial vote on Staten Island at JFK 8, there was another election at a very nearby warehouse called LDJ5, a smaller kind of 1,500-person facility that's, you know, just almost like across the street from the original warehouse. And that went not great, and they lost by a pretty wide margin. And I think some of the ALU organizers who were in charge of organizing that facility felt like Chris was basically absent. That had Chris kind of continued to hang out at the bus stop and continued to sort of press the case, that they might have done better. But instead, he was sort of out and about, you know, doing interviews and going across the country and just kind of soaking in the adulation of being this celebrity, that he neglected that campaign a bit. Now, I think there were important substantive reasons why they lost there. There's a different kind of workforce, much more part-time, and people were even more marginal economically than they had been in the other warehouse. So there were kind of some headwinds that they were facing that had nothing to do with Chris Smalls. But I think there was a sense, and some of the organizers have been quoted in the media saying, like, it felt like he abandoned us a little bit. It felt like he neglected us a little bit. So that was definitely an issue in the several weeks following the initial win.
One of, I think, the calling cards of the ALU was that it's independent, that it's small, that it's scrappy, that it did all this, you know, itself. And I guess I wonder where you see both the successes and failures associated with that, with not being kind of part of a big labor organization.
I think you have this established incumbent labor movement that has been shrinking by a little bit every year, but still generates a ton of money, you know, billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars from member dues. And then you have all this energy from this more sort of the kind of guerrilla precincts of the labor movement, where it's just workers on their own organizing. In some cases, it's not even trying to form an NLRB certified union. It's just doing some kind of labor action, you know, a walkout or a boycott or, you know, some action to raise the salience of the issue that they are worried about. And there's been a lot of energy around that part of the labor movement. And so you have one end of the movement, which is like really well resourced, but conservative, and another end of the movement, which is not well resourced at all, but has a ton of energy and a ton of initiative. And I do think there are times when the incumbent conservative portion of the movement has sort of been shamed, you know, by these younger, less experienced, but less risk averse folks who are just kind of like learning as they go. And I think the newcomers are sort of expanding the understanding of what's possible. If you'd have asked anyone 2 years ago whether you could organize 250 Starbucks stores in a year, people would have been pretty skeptical of that, and certainly skeptical that that was worth an investment of an existing union's money. But these workers kind of took the initiative and did it, and they kind of got out ahead of where the established labor movement was, and the established labor movement kind of found itself having to catch up, you know, or being marginalized further if they didn't adjust.
When we come back, the second biggest employer on the planet is not shy about spending to stop the union.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you, fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at Progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Part of what made the ALU's victory at JFK 8 so extraordinary was the David and Goliath nature of it all. But Amazon is still Amazon. The company's resources are essentially limitless. And after being caught off guard once, officials there seem determined not to let it happen again.
They've held meetings, you know, the term of art in the labor movement is captive audience meetings, where they bring, you know, a dozen or two or three people into a room, and they say things like, well, you know, this union doesn't have much of a track record. Are you sure they're going to be able to deliver on their promises? Or, you know, labor negotiations are inherently uncertain. Maybe you'll do better, but maybe you'll do worse. And you have good benefits now, so do you really want to take that risk? So there's a lot of like, just kind of question raisings. You know, I'm just asking.
I'm just asking questions.
You know, that's kind of the strategy. I think Amazon is probably a little harder edged in just its pretty relentless refusal to acknowledge the union, acknowledge any progress by the union. You know, as I said, they immediately challenged the result of this election. They had 25 abductions. You know, companies challenge union elections all the time, so that's not so crazy, but just the kind of amount of resources and effort spent in challenging was somewhat unusual and impressive.
In Amazon's view, Noam says, a union would chip away at what the company values most, control. Controlling how packages get from point A to point B, but also every part of the process along the way, including what employees do and how they do it.
I think Amazon has very clearly sent a message to employees that it's still in charge. It still controls what goes on here. And I think we saw that most recently with this fire that we mentioned at JFK 8. This cardboard compactor catches fire. The warehouse is evacuated. They send the people from the day shift home, but then the night shift people get there and they still smell the smoke and they're worried. And so a lot of them meet in the break room and say, yeah, we're not so comfortable working our shift today. We want a little more information from you about fire safety. We want something done about this. But Amazon the next day suspended, you know, more than 60 of these workers with pay. But, suspension is a pretty bold step. Just having the ability at any moment to suspend people and demonstrating that you're willing to do that is certainly, interpreted by the union as a shot across the bow, as something that worries employees and makes them less likely to do this kind of thing in the future.
Maybe this is a silly and naive question, but I kind of want to ask it anyway. Why is Amazon so adamantly anti-union? Is it just about money?
Yeah, I think in Amazon's case, and you could argue at a company like Starbucks too, I think it's less money per se. As I said, Amazon just raised wages at most of its warehouses across the country. And in some cases, the wage increase was $1, $1.50. So they're willing to spend money. They say they're spending $1 billion over the next year raising wages, which is not nothing. I think for them, it's more about control. It's about the process. Amazon really prides itself on optimizing, on kind of process engineering, on making the kind of internal the movements of inventory from point A to point B to point C as absolutely efficient as it possibly can be, because they're trying to get you your package, now within a couple of hours at times. And so Amazon thinks that its success is bound up with these very quick turnarounds, same day, next day delivery. And in order to do that, it has to have the ability to optimize within the warehouses. And if there is a union, that union will have the ability to throw sand in those gears and go toe-to-toe with Amazon and say, we know you're trying to optimize this, but our workers are not, picking 300 items an hour. So I think it really is about optimizing efficiency. It's about speed, and it's ultimately in service of this goal of, we want to get you these packages as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And if there's a union there, it's not going to be possible to do that.
There's some macroeconomic background here that I think is interesting and important to touch on. Like, one of the things that has made Amazon hard to unionize is that workers don't stay that long. And then at the same time, right now, we're starting to see a potentially softening labor market, though recent jobs numbers were good. Like, the Fed is trying to slow things down. And I wonder if having a slowing labor market potentially throws a wrench in front of the union.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. Historically, we've seen more strike activity, more organizing activity when the labor market is really tight. And you can understand why. People think,
yeah, they have power.
Yeah, they have power, and it's less scary, right? I mean, the big anxiety in your head, if you're a worker who's sticking your neck out to try to organize a union or to go on strike, is, will I get fired? And in a tight labor market, getting fired is just not as scary. But if suddenly we go into a recession, then it does get a lot more scary. And I think a lot of workers do think twice about that. It's not like every worker is hanging on to like every word of the Fed's minutes. But you start to notice when, it gets tougher for your roommate to get a job, or your wife left her job and thought she would get a job really easily, and now it turns out she can't get a job that easily. These things matter. And historically, we've seen that organizing and striking just gets a lot harder when unemployment is a lot higher.
What do you think happens in this election in Albany?
I think it's a harder slog in Albany. As I said, you have a little bit less of an organic organization there. I think workers are a little more skeptical there than they were at JFK. You do have, as I say, some folks where familiarity with the union has bred, some amount of skepticism, if not contempt. And Amazon, I think, is probably a little more vigilant today than it was, in March. I think Amazon probably suffered a bit from not taking the ALU very seriously. It was this ragtag group of workers who had never organized anything in their lives. And Amazon, probably assumed that that was, all you needed to know about this union. And now they very much take this threat seriously. They've been very, aggressive with these anti-union meetings. They're not taking any chances. So I think It'll be harder to replicate this at a facility like ALB1. But that said, you know, there are some legitimate frustrations. I mentioned safety. I think also people are frustrated with this sense that like Amazon can just kind of arbitrarily discipline you and you don't really know why and you don't really have any recourse. That's something I heard many times from workers when I was up there. So, you know, I think there's definitely reasons that workers would want to vote for the union, and workers have told me that's why they are. I just think this is at this point, it's difficult to replicate. You know, you're not sneaking up on the company anymore.
I think a risk of being a reporter is like, we're always looking for trends, right? We want to know if this thing is part of a group, if it's do or die or whatever. And I wonder how much this outcome matters for the ALU and how much it is a part of like the larger story about unions and worker power right now. And if there's any way to disentangle those things.
I think this election matters a fair amount for the ALU. I think, you know, we've discussed some of the questions that, you know, reporters and workers and other union officials have about the ALU. Those are legitimate questions. And if this this election goes sideways, you know, people will be well within their rights to raise more questions about the ALU. You know, I think... Amazon matters so much to the labor movement. You know, it touches so many industries. And whenever it enters a new industry, it kind of sets the standard in that industry. You know, I remember when Amazon a few years ago announced that it was buying Whole Foods, and suddenly, like, you know, the stock prices of like Kroger and, you know, and other big supermarket chains like dropped precipitously, because everybody knows that once Amazon is in an industry, it kind of dictates the business model of other players in that industry. So the labor movement is absolutely right to focus on Amazon. Every time it enters a new industry, it touches a whole new group of workers. And if the labor movement can't figure out a way to get some leverage over Amazon, then it really is, you know, it's an existential issue for them. They're going to have a hard time organizing any private sector workers if they can't figure out this Amazon puzzle. They know that this is existential, and, you know, they know that that this is a years-long project. And so I think would everyone be heartened and kind of encouraged if they won at ALB1? Absolutely. But if they lose there, I think they are no less determined to keep at this and try to organize this company, or at least get a foothold in the company, than they were the day before. This is just not a fight that the labor movement can lose. That doesn't mean they will win, but it means they can't back down, and that they kind of have to throw what they have at it over a period of years, maybe even decades, and not just months.
Noam Shiver, thank you so much for your reporting and for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great to talk this through with you.
Noam Shiver covers labor issues for the New York Times. And that is it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell. Our show is edited by Jonathan Fisher. Joanne Levine is the executive producer for What Next. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate. TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and it's also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. And if you are a fan of the show, I have a request for you. Become a Slate Plus member. You can get all your lovely Slate podcasts ad-free. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.